You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
This episode of On Brand is brought to you by 2020. You know that stock photography look you hate? Like how all the models have those creepy, dead-behind-the-eyes smiles? 2020 lets you buy millions of intimate, authentic, real-world photos. They look like they came from someone's social media account you're jealous of, and they're proven to increase your brand's image. You get 5 photos with 2020's 1-week free trial at 2020.com/onbrand. That's the word 20, then the number 2 and the number 0.com/onbrand to get your first 5 photos free.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? This week's guest is Anne Barr Thompson. With more than 25 years of experience as a global brand strategist, Anne Barr Thompson is an accomplished researcher, writer, and speaker, the pioneer of the strategic framework of brand citizenship, and a Trust Across America 2018 top thought leader in trust. A former executive director of strategy and planning and head of consulting at Interbrand, the world's leading brand consultancy, Anne founded 164th, a boutique consultancy to integrate cultural shifts and a social conscience into brand development. Her writings have appeared in Economist Books, HBR.org, The Guardian, Brand Quarterly, Bloomberg News, and many other publications. Anne's new book, Do Good, Embracing Brand Citizenship to Fuel Both Purpose and Profit, is available in stores and online now. Anne, welcome to On Brand.
Oh, well, thank you, Nick. Glad to be here.
So I am excited to talk about all of this, about doing good. And I'm sure that there is something that we can even cite. I'm so excited about doing this, and I would imagine that there's a parallel that when we participate in things about doing good, we feel better. But before we get there, going kind of meta in thinking about branding, I'm always struck by an interesting name that I can't immediately unpack. So what's the story behind the name of your consultancy, 164th?
Well, funny, I didn't expect you to ask that, Nick. But it's an interesting story, and it's an easy one to tell in an elevator ride with a CEO. So do you know anything about Egyptian mythology?
I, in fact, do not.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure I knew that much either until I uncovered this story researching naming roots. So there's 3 characters in this Egyptian story. The first one is Horus, and he's the falcon god. And he is the god of the sky. So he oversees the skies and has that great eye that you see in every Egyptian cartouche. Then you have Seth, and he's the evil god of the underworld. And dependent upon the angle you look at in this family tree, Seth is Horus's stepbrother, cousin, uncle, because you know Egyptians had some interesting family dynamics and family trees. And then the hero of the story in many ways is Thoth. And Thoth is the god of art, science, and wisdom. And he's the serpent and staff that you see in medicine. So we have Horus, the falcon god, Seth, the god of the underworld, and Thoth, the god of art, science, and wisdom and medicine, let's say. So Seth is jealous of Horus, and he rips his eye out and tears it into shreds. And everyone says Horus is done for. He can no longer fly the skies and view everything and you know, save us from that perspective. And Thoth steps in and says, no, I can put his eye back together. And he puts Horus's eye back together in perfect proportion. But when you actually add the fractions of the proportions of the eye, you only get 63/64. So as the story goes, you have to take things apart and put them back together in perfect proportion. But if you don't leave that 1/64 of room for magic and room to breathe, putting it back together in perfect proportion doesn't work. And that's how a brand works. You need some space for magic and some space for room for people to breathe and perform their magic on that 63/64.
That is amazing. That's also how a story works, because it should have something unexpected in it. And I did not know how we were going to get from Egyptian gods to the story of a numeric name like that. So
yes,
very interesting.
So we're that 1/64 that Toth brought to bear, putting it back together.
That is great. So on the front of your framework of brand citizenship, the topic of your new book, Doing Good, how does one, it seems like a new space for brands to be concerned with. I want to ask how someone gets involved in this specific discipline, because it doesn't seem like it seems like it's more of a pathway in the study of brands today than it once was. But how did you get here?
Oh, so how did I get to brand citizenship? So it's interesting, because, you know, purpose is the big thing, and purpose started emerging probably around 2009, even though most people really hadn't heard of the notion of brand purpose till probably the past 3 years, let's say. But it wasn't by that route. And many people just assumed that somewhere in 2011-ish, I decided I was going to come up with a model to, you know, make brands behave better, help companies behave more responsibly in an integrated manner. But that isn't at all what happened. At the end of 2011, we were conducting some trend research to, if I'm to be boldly honest, just come up with 5 easy to talk about trends for 2012. And we fielded a study for the first time amongst a population we often fielded studies with. And the answers we got back really surprised us. We asked people about what their hopes and dreams were for the coming year, what their fears were. And we also asked them some closed-ended questions about the economy and various other things in that area. And then we asked them which brands they thought would exhibit leadership in the coming year, which brands they considered to be leaders, which brands they thought were good corporate citizens, which brands they thought were bad corporate citizens. And we asked them to name 3 to 5 in each of those categories, as well as tell us why they were naming these brands. And you, as a savvy brand person, probably know that when people do a lot of these ranking studies, there's often a closed-ended set of brands being reviewed or analyzed.
Right.
This was completely open-ended. So, and I know this because I actually combed through the answers myself to help with coding. There was over 2,200 names of companies mentioned, names of brands mentioned. And within that, people even mentioned politicians and things. And it was sort of took us aback that that was in there when we were saying corporate citizens, good corporate citizens, and we're getting politicians' names, or bad corporate citizens, and we're getting politicians' names. Now, we didn't have the data, these open-ended questions coded, so we didn't have someone in a back room come up with 3 words to explain someone's long sentences and start making these responses more hygienic almost. It takes away a lot of the color when people code data. We actually read every response ourselves. So it was me, 2 of my senior people, and some interns, and we read, I can't tell you how many responses because I never counted them because it was a frightening one. And what happened was, is under the surface was this big sentiment that people were asking businesses to step in and start solving the problems that government wasn't solving. Had we had the data coded by coders in a research firm, we would have never felt this. But because we were reading these responses about their hopes and dreams and their fears, in combination with reading the responses about why they name brands as leaders, why they name brands as good corporate citizens and bad corporate citizens, you felt something really deep under the surface. And it's just the way, sort of, if I'm to say it honestly, my mind works, and I just connect dots in different ways. So the dots were starting to connect in a way that was really surprising. And I decided over the next 3 years to grant myself some money to start deconstructing brand leadership from good corporate citizenship and favorite brands, which acted as a proxy for brand loyalty in our research. And that's sort of how it came about. So the model makes a lot of sense to people when they start understanding it, because it's a grassroots up model. It wasn't something we set out in a boardroom, a classroom, or a conference room to create. So it feels natural because it was the natural way people flowed in their expectations from brands based upon the zeitgeist. And that's sort of how it all came about.
That's so cool. It's maybe a big leap of a question and one of those things that is a double-edged sword with research. But any thinking on why people are looking to brands? Because that is such a surprising insight.
Well, we see it now. I mean, look what's going on the past few weeks with gun control.
Absolutely.
And people demanding that companies pull out of it. Look at the Me Too movement. Prior to that, when the Supreme Court passed a new ruling, we had companies displaying, the rainbow flag for gay rights. We've had companies step up for immigration. So what's happening is, because people are frustrated, and they don't see government solving problems, they see government as polarizing things, they see business as being responsible now to step up and step in and sort of start earning their keep. But what's important is this debate of what role business plays in society is actually not a new debate. It's a very old one, and probably as old as business itself. And it comes and goes in different ways. And I talk about some of that in chapter 2, which is about our changing value system, and also in chapter 6 in my book, which is about step 3, responsibility, some of the history. So you start understanding, whilst it seems new and whilst it seems that this is a new calling for business, it's a different face of a calling that's come and gone over the decades, if not the centuries.
So is there a kind of a Cliff's Notes of recent history of some of these phases? Because, it is one of those things that I would think many would think, well, we don't touch issues. And I think increasingly we look at examples with the NRA, with others, where I think people are looking to brands for leadership. Can you talk a little bit about what that struggle has looked like in the different phases of that debate?
Yeah, I can just give you a quick overview because it gets really detailed.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I go into slight more detail in my book, but clearly this is not even, I don't even think it's a class someone would take in a semester. I think it's pretty much a college thesis or a PhD thesis. But if you think about it in the most recent times that people can actually put in context and really start envisioning would be the turn of the 18th to 19th century the 1800s to 1900s, so the 19th to 20th century and the industrial era. You start thinking about some of the industrial titans that came in and started building factory towns. Some of them did it because they felt their workers did deserve better conditions, and others did it because it was just proven that workers that are in better conditions and eat better and live in better homes work better. So that tension between doing it just for the sake of doing it and doing it because it benefits us has always been there. But at the end of the day, as long as we're bettering people's lives, that's the part I believe we should focus on, not necessarily that companies are looking to earn money, because companies need to earn money to keep themselves up. John Lewis Partnership is a British company that really started with all its employees as partners. Actually, it was the second generation. The son came in and took over the business and had this vision of a company that could treat employees better and create a fairer society. And since the early 1900s, John Lewis Partnership, which is both a department store and owns a supermarket or a grocery store in the UK called Waitrose, has behaved like this toward its employees since the beginning. They have a farm that they allow employees to go to on vacation, all sorts of things. Their benefits grow deep and wide. And again, that's a company that started doing this around that turn of the industrial era and then moved on and has continued to modify and express it in a way that's modern. If you think about movies that people would, or films people would recognize, like Aaron Brockovich, there was a movement of this in the 70s. And right before that, in the 40s and 50s, some of this was going on. And it was around that time when the concept of corporate social responsibility started coming into play. Before that, between that turn of the industrial age and that movement that started happening in the 40s and 50s, in the 19-teens, you go, and in the book I talk about some of these debates that went on with Yale Law School professors, Harvard Business School professors, who were saying, what is business's role in society? And one of the deans of the Harvard Business School back in, I don't know the exact date, maybe it was 1919, somewhere plus or minus 5 years in there, he stepped up and he actually said business has a larger role and a larger responsibility in society to play in a speech that he did, I believe, if I remember correctly, and all this is detailed in my book, and forgive me, some of the details sometimes slip my mind, but I believe it was a commencement speech that he said this. Dunham was his surname. So this has been going on as a debate on and off, and it makes sense. Business is a large institution in society. Companies earn more than GDPs of countries. So the expectations we have for them, it's not surprising that we want them to take a larger role in bettering our individual lives. And this is one of the biggest premises that came out from my research about brand citizenship. It's not only bettering society. Your role as a business is to first better my life and then span out and progress society. So it's not just about bettering society as an absolute. You'd be a nonprofit if you did that. You have to first solve my problems as your customer. And I think that notion of solving my problems as a customer and behaving responsibly and moving out is actually very reflective of Peter Drucker's philosophies, if you've ever read any of his management essays.
I have, and that's a great tie and a great history too. I think that sometimes, you know, we live in the rapid changing moment so often that we forget about some of these that have been, like you said, different aspects of a much larger conversation, especially on this topic. When you were talking about the study that first brought some of these ideas to light, you also talked about a closed set of responses. And I would imagine that brought some new brands to the forefront as being exemplary of the kind of leadership that people are looking for. What are some of those kind of exemplary actors in this?
So let me just correct one thing. So the closed-ended responses were more a series of questions we asked about what matters to you most in terms of problems. So like the economy, global issues, blah, blah. The set of brands we asked was open-ended, but that actually makes it more interesting because it wasn't that we asked people about specific brands. We asked them to name brands. And the brands that rose to the top, these players you're asking about, were part of the insights that intrigued me to actually go and invest a significant amount of money and grant myself a significant amount of money to deconstruct this over the 3 years it took to do so. And the one that jumped up first, that rose to the surface, and I think it was in the 30% in the first study in both the US and the UK, was Apple. So Apple was named by more respondents than any other brand as the number one good corporate citizen. Now, this was really surprising to us because back in 2011, Apple was being lambasted for supplier relationships, right, especially toward the end of the year, which was when the study was done. The media, activists, social responsibility experts were all really on Apple's case. So here now we have real people telling us that Apple is the number one good corporate citizen. So why? And this is where the really interesting insights start coming into play. Because Apple has transformed the way I communicate with people across the globe. Because Apple has brought joy into my life by bringing music into it 24/7. So Apple had transformed and enriched individual people's lives. And that was why they were calling it a good corporate citizen. Similar to that, although from a different perspective, you had Walmart in the US and Tesco in the UK, who were also rising to the top, and I believe it was in the top three in the first study, that Walmart and Tesco were good corporate citizens because they had lower pricing, and because of their pricing policies, I was afforded a better lifestyle. So this huge me proposition in there. And the other one that was a bit surprising was Ford, not because Ford actually isn't a good corporate citizen. Walmart has amazing initiatives, but for other reasons that we'll probably jump into later, Walmart is not thought of as a good corporate citizen. And actually, I'll just quickly say it has a lot to do with how they treat employees. And the five steps of my model illustrate why that prevents them from being seen as a good corporate citizen. And we can come back to that if you want later. But so Walmart and Tesco, good corporate citizens, not because of their technical corporate social responsibility initiatives or supply chain initiatives, but because of their pricing policy and what that affords me in my life. Then you had Ford, which actually has some amazing corporate social responsibility initiatives also, and community initiatives. But Ford wasn't considered a good corporate citizen because of those. Ford was considered a good corporate citizen because in 2011, people were being told the economy after the 2008 recession and big crash was turning around. But most people were not feeling this economic turnaround they were being told about. They were still feeling quite a crunch. And this was another election year, different than the last election we went through, but still a pretty polarized election filled with a lot of tension. And people were saying, well, they're telling me the economy is doing better, but my life hasn't changed. My life is still under stress and still feeling worse than it did prior to 2008. But Ford is a good corporate citizen because Ford exhibits the turnaround we can all have. Ford has fixed their business, and this exhibits what Americans can do, and this exhibits how I can turn my life around. So this was really rather intriguing. Then the brands that trickled in that were really fragmented were the ones you would have expected. You know, a lot of the social enterprises or brands known for their community efforts and things like that. So that starts giving you a bit of a landscape of the playing field.
And just to call out what I would assume is the answer there, your Toms, your Warby Parkers, mm-hmm. Patagonia, the ones kind of, if you were to ask on the CSR question, probably those would be the most expected members of that list.
Yes, and you have Whole Foods, you have Lush, and I have a number of brands, Seventh Generation. Any brand that I highlight and profile in the book came from the research. It wasn't my personal opinion. So there's a number of brands, but they were all really fragmented. You know, they had one, two, three, four responses out of the over 900 people we were talking to. So it was fascinating to see this fragmentation in the real social responsibility stage. And what was rising to the surface was this notion of like more me brands. These are good corporate citizens because of what they do for me. And what that led to was this exploration. And what we found was that to be considered a good corporate citizen, you have to first and foremost, step one, is deliver on trust. And trust is your promise to your customers, your employees, your stakeholders. So there's different definitions in there. But if we make it somewhat simple and we stick with the customer level of brand citizenship, you have to begin by delivering what you promise to your customers, to do what you say, what you promise. So step one is all about trust.
So back to the Walmart point, because I do think that's interesting, because you do read about more and more that they're doing. And initially, as you were saying that, you said they have some wonderful initiatives, but people don't see it that way. And in my head, my first answer was, oh, is people have such a Walmart stigma? And I thought there's some other X factor, but you make it sound as though there's a simple list that one should follow that they might have some pretty critical holes in their coverage of.
Yes, that's actually an interesting way of putting it. No one's thought of it that way before, but it actually works. It's this, if you run through the five steps, and I'll label them quickly, and then I'll focus on where Walmart has some of its issues. So you start with this step one, as I said, you have to start with trust, delivering what you promise. Then you move to enrichment. And Apple is a brand people categorize as an enriching brand. It enriches and betters my life. Then you move to responsibility, and that's step three. And that's treat your employees well and fairly, first and foremost, and then you treat the environment, your suppliers, et cetera, fairly. So step three is really important because it's the pivot point between being what we think of as a me brand and what we think of as a we brand. So brands get, from our research, brands get categorized in one of each of the five steps, and I'll give you the last two in a moment. But to be considered a good brand citizen, even though you're strategically thought of at one of these five steps, a good brand citizen embodies all five steps. They go back and forth and have elements of each of the five, even though strategically people put them in a box of enriching my life or a brand I really trust or a brand that really behaves responsibly. So this responsibility is this notion of how you get move from being considered purely a me brand or a me brand with we sensibilities. And the we steps are for community, and that's about bringing people together through shared values, not just social media communities. It's much bigger than that. And the one of the examples that always surprises people is IBM, which back in 2004, before Facebook, had a digitally based and electronically based values jam over 3 days where any IBMer was welcome to participate and say what made IBM IBM. It was a way to heal IBM when it had become financially stronger but lost a lot of its cultural glue as it became financially stronger. So anyone could participate. So they built a community of IBMers held together through shared values of what makes IBM great. Other examples of community are B2B communities. The Forest Stewardship Council is a B2B community that brings companies together that want to sustain forests, even though they use a lot of paper products. And not only do they offer a certification if you behave a certain way or supply chain, they connect companies together so that they can learn from each other and better their issues. So you can start seeing how community has a really interesting different twist than how we think of community as social media communities. GiftGap, which is a UK mobile company, is another brand that's an amazing example of community. They don't have customer service. Their customers service each other. And that's a community they've built because they believe in the way this company conducts business, how it charges fees, et cetera, et cetera. It does have investment from some larger mobile companies, telephony companies, but it behaves in its own way. And over time, in a very short period of time, it became the number three UK provider of mobile without customer service. Who would ever have thought that? That people answer each other's queries faster than customer service would. And then step five is contribution, which is more the social enterprises. You know, brands like Seventh Generation, you would put the Warby Parkers there. I talk about a cosmetics, handmade cosmetics brand that has naked packaging and great supply chain, Lush in the book. And I also talk about a base brand, Kenko, which is a coffee brand, which builds community and or a contribution, the notion of contribution and contributing more through buying its products and services through an initiative called Coffee and Gangs, which gives teenagers in Honduras an alternate choice from being killed, joining a gang, or leaving a company when they hit a country when they hit a certain age. And it gives scholarships to have these teenagers learn to become coffee growers. And imagine if Kenko built community with other coffee manufacturers and created something that ran across all of South America with the NGO it works with, where all coffee manufacturers offer these scholarships to teenagers. You could change a continent. You could change people's lives. So to put that back in summary so you get the picture in total, it's trust, enrichment, responsibility, community, and contribution.
Well, that is a great rundown, and we're actually close on time, but I want to ask one more question because this is it's a different part of an ongoing conversation, but I think especially with so many of the movements that you've mentioned, I think it's becoming right now about more important than it's ever been. And if there is a brand builder sitting out there listening, thinking, we need to think about this more, I've listened to this, I'm excited, I'm also scared, I don't know where to start. What's a good logical next step? aside from the obvious one of buying a whole book that someone smart just wrote about this, which they should do anyway, what's the next step with them, with their team, to get the ball at least kind of rolling?
So, and this is really what's important, and there's so much more clearly to unpack in this, but the real first step is just having courage to commit to doing this and accepting there's no fixed formula. You know, in today's world, we just want a series of line items we can check off to do something. This is not about this. This is a long-term commitment and a long-term journey. And you just decide you're going to figure it out and figure it out in the way that works best and best reflects your brand. It begins by, in its best way, it begins by identifying your purpose and then moving out from your purpose. In its simplest way, it's just start doing initiatives that reflect some of these notions, that start connecting what your brand's about with your philanthropy, with your cause marketing. Don't just do these as one-off initiatives. Connect them to what you're about and start taking the journey, because it is a journey that you will make mistakes on. And it's about taking risks, and it's about slightly making yourself vulnerable. And there's some really great brands out there who have recently made some really big mistakes. Mm-hmm. But you have to give them credit for at least trying, that they're on this journey and they're experimenting with a new way of doing things.
Boy, and that's a hard thing too, that last point, because I think we also live in this zeitgeist where we pounce on someone, mm-hmm. and some of the mistakes are pretty knuckleheaded. So without letting someone off the hook for that, I also think we have to do exactly what you said and understand that there are some tough questions being asked here. Well, speaking of tough questions, Anne, I in all of our run-up, I forgot to warn you about the closest thing to a gotcha question that I have.
Oh, but
we've talked about so many brands. I always close with a brand that has made you smile recently. And I would think in your line of work, that can't be. You have to be tracking some of those brand enrichments that you're having.
So I'm actually going to sort of bridge and deflect on the question, because there's not one brand out there that's made me smile. I have personal brands that I like and I love because of what they're doing and how they behave and how they do it in a surprising way. But for me, the brands that make me smile are the brands that the people that I spoke to in my research name, brands that are out there trying to align purpose and profit, you know, that are shaping responsible business practices. And there's so many brands out there that to name one would sort of undermine. And to the point you just made, my goal is to help us start recognizing what people are doing right. I do think we need to pounce on companies who are purposefully behaving irresponsibly. But we also have to recognize that humans run these companies. And sometimes people make the wrong choices for the wrong reasons, but sometimes people make the wrong choice for the right reason. And if we continue to out people rather than out them in a way of what they're doing right, we create a polarized environment in a time when we're trying to bring things together and fix problems, in a time we need to bring things together and fix problems. And it can't just be a company's responsibility. You can't just blame fast fashion companies, for example, for what they produce if you keep buying their stuff. They're trying to do circular fashion, but people aren't necessarily buying it. Now, granted, sometimes they price too high on these things when they really cost the same thing. Almond milk is cheaper in the supermarket than regular milk, at least the ones I buy, and I think they're pretty decent brands, but yet I walk into coffee stores and they mark up yeah. when I ask for almond milk. So yeah. That's kind of wrong. But I think anyone who's trying and is trying in a sincere way from the heart deserves credit. And those are the brands that make me smile, and there's countless ones. There's too many to name.
You know, initially when you started and said I'm going to deflect, I will confess I sat here and deflated. I'm like, oh, but your reason for deflecting in the line of work that you're in and what people cite I think that's a great answer. And as unexpected as the story that you told at the top of the show. And thanks for joining us on Brand. And where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
Brandcitizenship.com is an easy way to do some of it. I'm at Ann with an EBT on Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn as Ann Barr Thompson, and hopefully they'll see how to spell my name because it would take too long to do that. 164th.com, which is slightly harder to spell, also is also another way. But brandcitizenship.com, Twitter, and LinkedIn are probably fast links to everything.
Well, great. Well, we will link up to all of that in our show notes. And thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And before we go, I always like to flip the microphone around to our community. This past week, Michael Libby posted an interview that I did at the AMA Experience event on his show, Insight on Business. Mike, thanks for getting the word out. And thanks again to our sponsor, 2020, your source for on-brand photography for your brand. Get 5 free photos with their trial at 2020.com/onbrand. That's the word 20, then the number 20.com/onbrand. On Brand is a production of Brand Driven Digital, helping complex organizations simplify their branding and marketing to unlock growth. More, including the links to everything Ann and I discussed, at branddrivendigital.com. You can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over there, do some good, and give us a quick rating and review to help others find the show. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.